The taste of the fruits of temporal knowledge draws the concentration of the spirit away from the center of the aeon to the peripheral crisis of the moment. The balance of perfection is lost. The spirit falters, and the hero falls. The idea of the insulating horse to keep the hero out of immediate touch with the earth and yet permit him to promenade among the peoples of the world is a vivid example of a basic precaution taken generally by the carriers of supernormal power. Montezuma, Emperor of Mexico, never set foot on the ground. He was always carried on the shoulders of noblemen, and if he lighted anywhere, they laid a rich tapestry for him to walk upon. Within his palace, the king of Persia walked on carpets on which no one else might tread. Outside of it, he was never seen on foot, but only in a chariot or on horseback. Formerly, neither the kings of Uganda, nor their mothers, nor their queens might walk on foot outside of the spacious enclosures in which they lived. Whenever they went forth, they were carried on the shoulders of men of the buffalo clan, several of whom accompanied any of these royal personages on a journey and took it in turn to bear the burden. The king sat astride the bearer's neck with a leg over each shoulder and his feet tucked under the bearer's arms. When one of these royal carriers grew tired, he shot the king under the shoulders of a second man, without allowing the royal feet to touch the ground. Sir James George Fraser explains in the following graphic way the fact that over the whole earth, the divine personage may not touch the ground with his foot.
Apparently, holiness, magical virtue, taboo, or whatever we may call that mysterious quality which is supposed to pervade sacred or tabooed persons, is conceived by the primitive philosopher as a physical substance or fluid with which the sacred man is charged, just as a Leyden jar is charged with electricity, and exactly as the electricity in the jar can be discharged by contact with a good conductor, so the holiness or magical virtue in the man can be discharged and drained away by contact with the earth, which, on this theory, serves as an excellent conductor for the magical fluid. Hence, in order to preserve the charge from running to waste, the sacred or tabooed personage must be carefully prevented from touching the ground. In electrical language, he must be insulated, if he is not to be emptied of the precious substance or fluid with which he, as a vial, is filled to the brim. And in many cases, apparently the insulation of the tabooed person is recommended as a precaution not merely for his own sake, but for the sake of others. For since the virtue of holiness is, so to say, a powerful explosive which the smallest touch may detonate, it is necessary in the interest of the general safety to keep it within narrow bounds, lest breaking out it should blast, blight, and destroy whatever it comes into contact with.
There is no doubt a psychological justification for the precaution. The Englishman, dressing for dinner in the jungles of Nigeria, feels that there is reason in his act. The young artist wearing his whiskers into the lobby of the Ritz will be glad to explain his idiosyncrasy. The Roman collar sets apart the man of the pulpit. A 20th century nun floats by in a costume from the Middle Ages. The wife is insulated, more or less, by her ring. The tales of W. Somerset Maugham describe the metamorphoses that overcome the bearers of the white man's burden who neglect the taboo of the dinner jacket. Many folk songs give testimony to the dangers of the broken ring. And the myths, for example, the myths assembled by Ovid in his great compendium, The Metamorphoses, recount again and again the shocking transformations that take place when the insulation between a highly concentrated power center and the lower power field of the surrounding world is, without proper precautions, suddenly taken away. According to the fairy lore of the Celts and Germans, a gnome or elf, caught abroad by the sunrise, is turned immediately into a stick or a stone. The returning hero, to complete his adventure, must survive the impact of the world. Rip Van Winkle never knew what he had experienced. His return was a joke. Oisin knew, but he lost his centering in it and so collapsed. Kamar al-Zaman had the best luck of all. He experienced awake the bliss of deep sleep and returned to the light of day with such a convincing talisman of his unbelievable adventure that he was able to retain his self-assurance in the face of every sobering disillusionment. While he was sleeping in his tower, the two jinn, Danash and Maimuna, transported from distant China the daughter of the Lord of the Islands and the Seas and the Seven Palaces. Her name was the Princess Budur, and they placed this young woman asleep beside the Persian prince in the very bed. The jinn uncovered the two faces and perceived that the couple were as like as twins. "By Allah," declared Danash, "O my lady, my beloved is the fairer." But Maimuna, the female spirit, who loved Kamar al-Zaman, retorted, "Not so. The fairer one is mine." Whereupon they wrangled, challenging and counter-challenging, until Danash at last suggested they should seek an impartial judge. Maimuna smote the ground with her foot, and there came out of it an ifrit, blind in one eye, humpbacked, scurvy-skinned, with eye orbits slit up and down his face, and on his head were seven horns, four locks of hair fell to his heels, his hands were like pitchforks and his legs like masts, and he had nails like the claws of a lion, feet like the hoofs of the wild ass. The monster respectfully kissed the ground before Maimuna, and inquired what she would have him do. Instructed that he was to judge between the two young persons lying on the bed, each with an arm under the other's neck, he gazed long upon them, marveling at their loveliness, then turned to Maimuna and Danash and declared his verdict. "By Allah, if you will have the truth," he said, "the two are of equal beauty. Nor can I make any choice between them, on account of their being a man and a woman. But I have another thought, which is that we wake each of them in turn, without the knowledge of the other, and whichever is the more enamored shall be judged inferior in comeliness." It was agreed. Danash changed himself to the form of a flea and bit Kamar al-Zaman on the neck. Starting from sleep, the youth rubbed the bitten part, scratching it hard because of the smart, and meanwhile turned a little to the side. He found lying beside him something whose breath was sweeter than musk and whose skin softer than cream. He marveled. He sat up. He looked better at what was beside him and discerned that it was a young woman like a pearl or shining sun, like a dome seen from afar on a well-built wall. Kamar al-Zaman attempted to wake her, but Danash had deepened her slumber. The youth shook her. "O my beloved, awake and look at me," he said. But she never stirred. Kamar al-Zaman imagined Budur to be the woman whom his father wished him to marry, and he was filled with eagerness. But he feared that his sire might be hiding somewhere in the room, watching, so he restrained himself and contented himself with taking the seal ring from her little finger and slipping it on his own. The ifrits then returned him to his sleep. In contrast with the performance of Kamar al-Zaman was that of Budur. She had no thought or fear of anyone watching. Furthermore, Maimuna, who had awakened her with female malice, had gone high up her leg and bitten hard in a place that burned. The beautiful, noble, glorious Budur, discovering her male affinity beside her, and perceiving that he had already taken her ring, unable either to rouse him or to imagine what he had done to her, and ravaged with love, assailed by the open presence of his flesh, lost all control, and attained to a climax of helpless passion.
Lust was sore upon her, for that the desire of women is fiercer than the desire of men, and she was ashamed of her own shamelessness. Then she plucked his seal ring from his finger and put it on her own instead of the ring he had taken, and bussed his inner lips and hands, nor did she leave any part of him unkissed. After which she took him to her breast and embraced him, and, laying one of her hands under his neck and the other under his armpit, nestled close to him and fell asleep at his side.
Dahnash therefore lost the argument. Budur was returned to China. Next morning, when the two young people awoke with the whole of Asia now between them, they turned to right and to left, but discovered no one at their side. They cried out to their respective households, belabored and slew people round about, and went entirely mad. Kamar al-Zaman lay down to languish. His father, the king, sat down at his head, weeping and mourning over him, and never leaving him, night or day. But the princess Budur had to be manacled. With a chain of iron about her neck, she was made fast to one of her palace windows. The encounter and separation, for all its wildness, is typical of the sufferings of love. For when a heart insists on its destiny, resisting the general blandishment, then the agony is great. So too the danger. Forces, however, will have been set in motion beyond the reckoning of the senses. Sequences of events from the corners of the world will draw gradually together, and miracles of coincidence bring the inevitable to pass. The talismanic ring from the soul's encounter with its other portion in the place of recollectedness betokens that the heart was there aware of what Rip Van Winkle missed. It betokens, too, a conviction of the waking mind that the reality of the deep is not belied by that of common day. This is the sign of the hero's requirement, now, to knit together his two worlds. The remainder of the long story of Kamar al-Zaman is a history of the slow yet wonderful operation of a destiny that has been summoned into life. Not everyone has a destiny. Only the hero who is plunged to touch it and has come up again with a ring.